Investment Loss Trust Fund, HB 51 Appropriation of the Investment Loss Fund. Then we're going to take up SB 141, Establishing Capital Match Grants Program, SB 235, Establishing the Alaska Debt Retirement Fund, HB 46, Establishing the Alaska Aerospace Development Corporation, SB 273, relating to the establishment of Peer Review Committee on the Board of Chiropractic Examiners, SB 189, amending the Alaska Securities Act, SB 25, concerning the recovery of damages by the state and its municipalities, and other bills. If we get to them, we're subject to the conference committee. We will try again to have a late afternoon shift of today's schedule and pick up those bills that we may not get to this morning. We do have a session at 10, I believe, again today. The first bill before us is the one we thought about overnight here, well, the companion bills, HB 221 and HB 51. Do we have representative, Commissioner Keller, maybe some questions that have arisen overnight, and of course we've been primarily puzzling over potential funding sources to reach the entire liability outstanding. A couple of questions that arose in my conversations with folks last night were, one, whether or not the bill was structured to include more than this fiscal year's potential balance that would go into the statutory reserve fund, and second, whether, to reiterate what you told us yesterday about what happens when the auditors come in and what they're looking for and what they have to see before, you know, pending their write-down of further write-down of policies. If you could identify yourself for the record.
I'm Millett Keller, Commissioner of Administration, and Jim Baldwin is with me from the Attorney General's office. The auditors look at the total that we're showing in all 22,000 accounts. Actually, it's more, slightly more than that, but roughly 22,000 accounts. They add up the balances we're showing in those accounts, and then they look at the assets that we have to support those. And if they don't match, then the auditors say you have to either freeze a portion of those participant accounts or write down participant accounts so that the balances in the participants match what your real assets are. So the question the auditors will be faced with, has the legislature really replaced those executive life assets with real assets? If they're not, I mean, if it's something that's going to require a future appropriation, then they're going to say, you don't have the assets and you can't show them in the participants' accounts, and we'll have to keep the participants' accounts frozen the way they are now until the assets are there. And they'll get there either by a future appropriation or by protracted litigation in through where we're trying to recover. We have another problem that we didn't mention yesterday that, specifically, but there's a class action lawsuit that's been filed against the state on this issue, and if and we'll have to respond to that suit. Our plans are to try to settle as part of this the class action suit so that we won't be sued subsequently. If the appropriation isn't made but in this session, then that lawsuit is going to proceed because the grounds for dismissing it won't be there. So we'll have to proceed and defend ourselves against the suit. So I think that it's not just an audit question, but we're going to have a litigation question that we'll be faced with this summer.
Okay, so then, back to the first question. What is real money, and what does the current House passed version before us do relative to real money for either this fiscal year or future fiscal years?
Well, it's my understanding that the intention is that as of July 1st, that the SBS funds, the SBS account would have what amounts to an appropriation that it can book as an asset.
Okay, the question is, how does the $93 million, I mean, that is not necessarily, in my mind, the same as real money, right? I mean, we won't even balance, for example, we won't even balance the books till when? September?
First September. I think maybe I can add something to this. First of all, we don't know what the loss is at this point, and we may not know for a period of time. what this bill does is take the most conservative approach to assuming that it will be a complete loss. And based on what we know now, assets and liabilities of the company don't match up very well. And we're not, at this point at least, we don't consider ourselves high on the priority list for when those assets are going to be distributed. So our position here is a very conservative one. The loss may be less, but in any case, it's not going to be established for some time yet.
So what does that mean to the auditors coming in, that they may not assume a total loss this summer?
Well, we've been advised by one set of auditors, or our potential auditors, that it is prudent for us now to wall off as much as would be equivalent to a 100% loss. And that's what we're doing through this freeze action. It's a walling off of...
Well, do you think that Section 2 of House Bill 51 walls off enough?
We have no basis to make that conclusion. We don't know what money's going to be remaining at the end of the fiscal year.
Well,
Section 2 in the appropriation bill as passed by the House?
Right.
It's uncertain to us what that means in terms of money.
We've based this on the fact that the Department of Revenue can make a reasonable forecast of revenues for the year, reasonably accurate forecast, and it will have some basis for how much spending will lapse, and that how much the legislature is planning to continue, in other words, to not allow it to lapse. But that there would be $93 million that would come up through this appropriation and not be whittled away by other appropriations.
Well, let's get back to the original question. Mr. Baldwin, when you read Section 2, does that, in your mind, limit it to just the 91 to 92 potential surplus, or could that be viewed as any time in the future the statutory budget reserve would accumulate up to $93 million? I mean, is that something of any comfort to the, you know, the administrative accounting process?
Well, Section 2 would take effect on the later of July 1, 1991, or the effective date of the accompanying bill. So I'm reading this to be a fiscal year 92 appropriation. From the statutory reserve fund.
I make no significant reading of Section 8 on the effective date. I think that's just a standard effective date. That doesn't answer the question, really, of what happens in the future. And it really isn't up to us. I guess I'm asking, really, what it means to you, or to your accountants, or to your auditors who are going to come in and try to estimate whether or not there are monies now or reasonably certain in the future to cover reasonably anticipated losses.
I think we agree with you. We won't know until the 1st of September what that appropriation is worth.
But the auditors will, that's about the time that the audit will be going on. I think we'll have a way to estimate, make a reasonable estimate of what, how much has been allowed to lapse into the statutory budget reserve fund. Particularly to know whether it's in the neighborhood of $93 million or in the neighborhood of $3 million. I mean, that would be known pretty early, I believe.
Well, let's say, for example, it's $60 million, but this law is still on the books, and it doesn't say, I would disagree, that it's this year's appropriation. I think another reading might be that it's whatever the balance may be of the statutory reserve fund in the future. I mean, wonder if it was 60 and there was another $33 million of potential liability out there, but this is still on the books, and there may or may not, there could be a balance in the 93 account in the statutory reserve.
What the auditors have told us is that without, because they'll do this when they do the audit, but the ground rules they would use if this does turn out to be only $60 million, that they would say that you are now $30 million deficient, which is roughly a fourth of the 20%. So you'll have to freeze or write down 6% instead of 20%. In other words, you can count on 15% having been delivered by this bill, and 5% is still yet to be delivered in one way or another, and so you'll have to freeze that 5% or 6% or whatever it turns out to be.
Senator Adams.
Yes. One of the things that we need to know, since we don't know the revenue versus the expenditures, and I don't want to freeze any state employees' wages once we leave here, so basically under section number 2, where you have the $93 million, I've offered up, Mr. Chairman, three ways to take care of that. The first way, you go through the budget, the statutory budget reserve, which I stated yesterday only had $3 million in there, and you won't know the exact numbers till perhaps September, when you know also this. My first amendment was, you have $118 million in the science and foundation technology. Since it was Cooper's administration that set that foundation, Cooper's administration that, and their state employees, put us in this particular position now, I don't see why that First Amendment can't be adopted to draw down from that. The third one was, my Second Amendment was taking it from the Constitution budget reserved. And I think that's viable, and I don't think there's no state employee should take a drawdown or freeze down. And so, Mr. Chairman, I'm just one of these things. I don't want to come back here in a special session in October so that we take care of this freeze down. So I thought maybe perhaps we can put these things in order. And what is wrong with using the science and foundation technology? What has it done for the state? And I think, I know that perhaps politically the Constitution budget reserve money, which has $285 million, perhaps political potential of not going that way, but it's one that with your political pressure that you can put on the, perhaps the Senate leadership, it passed over from the other body 37-2. And nothing that we can get 3/4 vote on this side to do that. So.
Further questions, comments?
What you want to do with this?
I don't know. I think that I mean, if your testimony was to try to indicate some reservations or uncertainties, I certainly share those, and I don't know whether we're solving any problems if we don't have 93, and we don't know whether we have 93, of course, till we're through our appropriations. But even more so, I would hate to get in a situation where the only reason the governor may be vetoing down stuff is to leave $93 million in the reserve to cover this appropriation. I you know, obviously that would undercut the will of the legislature as far as our appropriations. I don't think we want to walk blindly into that situation. At the same time, I think that in our conversations with other members of the Senate, at least, it is problematic on whether or not, you know, people want to utilize the constitutional reserve, and whether or not we would get 3/4 vote or not. There are people clearly that don't want to access other sources of revenue for the very reasons I just stated. Why don't we get? If we can, we've got some members missing here. Let me, if we could have a 2-minute at ease, let me get the other members here. Our members are still tied up here. They're needing about 5 more minutes. Why don't we temporarily set aside the two SBS bills and start discussion on SB 141, Establishing Capital Matching Grants Program. It also has an accompanying appropriation bill. This was a bill that we've heard at least once, if not twice, before. What in your packets, there's been ongoing discussions with the governor's office on possibly ways of accommodating what clearly is the governor's priority on establishing a capital project matching grant program for municipalities. In your packet is and I would bill it as a fairly rough draft, CS 4141, that we developed last night, trying to take into account some of the concerns expressed by members at a prior meeting. One of the things that was added is a new section, 1, on purpose, and I would urge members to take a look at that. And again, I'm not completely happy with the language of that. We had some disagreements with our bill drafters, and but the object of the new section 1 was to try to state the other circumstances under which continuing fully funded state projects, as well, including things like Priority One Schools. That's the AS 1411 is the statewide school capital construction program initiated by HB 37. Village Safe Water projects, other kinds of programs where the amounts of money clearly exceed any allocations to individual cities or municipalities. And then Section B there, and also the last sentence again speaks to continued need of other legislatively directed funding for local projects of local concern. Section B talks about what this program's purpose would be, to allow municipalities and other communities to initiate projects, to prioritize their projects, and to participate in those projects. The draft would leave most of the mathematical constructs that were adopted in the Senate Community and Regional Affairs Committee. They did change matching, at least for a two-year period, to no more than 30%, and then they reduced the minimum from 10 to 5%. The other weighting systems were left. The minimum amount would be continue to be $25,000. We added some perfecting language on the last page, on page 8, which, and actually throughout the bill, I guess, that talks about when the match occurs, and basically it would occur on each draw, so that you're not getting into a complex formula of what total project costs are. You come in for money, or municipality comes in for money, and they provide the match at the time under the formula for whatever amount of money under their allocation that they're applying for. In other talks with the governor is interested in some type of appropriation to accompany that. There's been a lot. The original bill called for approximately $60 million. There was other talk of trying to increase that amount. For purposes of discussion, I also had OMB do a run at a $40 million appropriation. And if you can take a look through that, when you maintain your minimum entitlements of $25,000 to unincorporated areas, and also the smallest of the municipalities, the problem obviously becomes that money, because of the minimum, is prorated differently among other municipalities that are above the minimum entitlement. So you get reduced percentages of the total when you move to smaller amounts of total appropriation. And you can check some of your own municipalities and see how that works. So there, we're on 141 and reviewing the proposed CS on the local capital match program. So there are some considerations when you move to lower amounts of money. The equity or the parity issues shift away from the larger communities. At the same time, it's obvious that as you go to larger amounts of money, that reduces the total amounts available for capital for other portions of the capital budget.
I'm sorry, where were you?
We're looking again at, we've set aside SBS temporarily till we can regain our membership, but we're taking a look at SB 141, and there's a rough draft CS in your packets that includes an additional purpose section, and also goes through and tries to clarify how the match would work. It also, I might add, includes a delayed effective date till July 1, 1992. And then there's, in discussion on some kind of appropriation level, I ask OMB to run a $40 million run, which is in your packet there. We're on 141, the match, the local
141,
right.
Yep.
So let me see, this is what, 40 million?
The question becomes, and you can check your own municipalities, is that as you drop the total amount of allocation, because of the minimal entitlement to unincorporated areas in the smallest municipalities, that money is shifted away from the larger ones, so that the relative proration or share changes downward for larger municipalities.
Yeah, we really do well, you know.
Sure. Yeah, if you have minimum defined grants, then the balance is...
It prorates against the larger revenues, so the smaller the appropriation.
How's Gino doing this?
Oh, good.
What I'd like to do is, if we could, if this bill will be still before us today, tomorrow, we're in ongoing talks with the administration on this. What I'd like to do is to have members get a chance to take a look at the Finance CS, and if people have suggestions as to language, we're more than open for them. We're, like I said, I too am a little bit concerned with some of the language. I don't think we've quite, in Section 1 particularly, captured quite what I think that our intent was here. If people have other questions or concerns, I'd be more than willing to hear them now or sometime today. Senator Adams?
Yes, I think my colleague and I have problems with perhaps the amount of funding per match and also for unincorporated communities of $25,000 at this particular time. That's our first one. On page 3, lines 9, we have a problem also with the statute. Does this allow for forced accounting? And perhaps that reference on page 3, I mean, page 3, lines 9, refers to an unconstitutional local hire law. That is the first one.
Just a minute, page 3, line 9?
Yeah. And so I'm just using these as a reference so we can go back and look at them. On page 4...
No, I'm sorry, could you restate? You're concerned that... Two things. One, does that allow continued force accounting?
Force accounting.
And two, does it...
Force accounting.
And it refers, and the reference there is to an unconstitutional local law, and we just need to look at that clearly. On page number 4, lines 6 and 7, and we want a clarification as far as matching money with other state funds, such as revenue sharing and municipal assistance. And could we or can't we? And clarification needs to be brought up on that particular point. The other area that we have concerns is page 4, subsection H. If the bill passes, we need to look at the property valuation.
I'm sorry, Al, where are you?
The next one I had is page 4, subsection H, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
It has to do with property and in-place resources. I believe that we need to clarify that particular language there.
To do what?
I don't know at this time. We need to look at this on its calculations and to see where we're going with that language.
What does it say now? It says, each city in the borough and per capita taxable real and personal property valuation of borough shall exclude the property valuation of each city in the borough. Because the city's getting separate.
So yeah, I just...
I believe this is the way that the revenue sharing calculation is made now. I think that's language out of the way that that's done now to account for how do you account for it when you have a borough surrounding incorporated municipalities.
Then how do you account for in-place resources within that particular borough?
Well, I mean, that obviously is a whole other topic. By the way, where is that legislation? Is that somewhere in the process?
Process. Page number 7 requires a law that a waiver of immunity must be signed by a native village council.
What line? Where at location is that?
That is probably on page
14 or?
Page 7, lines 12 and 13. Uh-huh. And we'd like to revisit as far as this particular item, as far as the waiver of immunity by a native village council. And basically, one of the things this piece of legislation does is leave... Even though he put this in statute, it leaves a lot of determinations up to regulations. So that is another concern that we have.
I would just respond to a couple of things generically. One, some of the things you mentioned obviously are problems that are not unique to this bill. They are problems or concerns with the revenue sharing municipal assistance calculations, waivers. Obviously that's the same issue that is involved in municipal or revenue sharing for a number of years now. I'm not sure whether we're going to solve some of those long-standing problems in this piece of legislation, but again, generically, I think that all of us would be the first to express uneasiness with this program and trying to do something at any kind of a last minute here. One of the safeguards here is to delay the effective date until July 1 of 92 to allow considerable interim work as well as possible legislative corrections, additions during the next session, to address some of these concerns. And again, it's not clearly the best way of doing business. It is, you know, frankly, an effort to try to do something within reasonable, limitations to address some major initiatives or concerns of the administration. Senator Hoffman.
Two other areas I would like to hit upon, Mr. Chairman, and that is the minimum entitlement. Yesterday we had a meeting with the governor, and he had indicated support for $50,000 as the minimum entitlement, and this was addressed at the last meeting. The concern, I guess, that I have is if there's a much-needed health clinic that costs $125,000, the community will not be able to build that facility for 5 years. And I think that it's very hard to build anything for $25,000 given the amount of needs in rural Alaska and the high construction costs out there. So I guess I would support the governor's position that maybe the minimum entitlement should go up. The other area of concern that I have in this particular piece of legislation is the accounting nightmare that it sets in place for all the municipalities in the state of Alaska, and I think that there may be some logic to exempting some of the smaller communities from the some of the requirements in here, because what we're going to end up doing is setting up a bureaucracy that's going to be pushing paper, following paper trails on matches, on carrying forward dollars, because there is not enough dollars to construct a project in rural areas of the state. They're going to be saving the dollars for 4, 5, 6, 7, maybe 8, 10 years, and I believe that's an accounting nightmare, and we need to look at a threshold level of maybe 1,000, 1,500, or 2,500 population for a community that, because I believe we're going to be spending more, too much money trying to account for the dollars than under this particular piece of legislation. And those are the two areas of concern that I would have on a first glance of the draft that you have, and there may be more as I'm able to review the legislation. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. Let me just respond to the first concern, because I come at it representing Anchorage from another angle. And I think if you see the chart for the $40 million, even maintaining the $25,000, you can see what happens to the percentage of money going to a community like mine. If you raise the minimum under that particular scenario, the larger communities would take even a larger downward proration of the share of the allocation. Conversely, if to satisfy the minimum, of course, what the governor, and I'm not trying to speak for the governor, but what I understood was if you move to $50,000, he would also move to perhaps a $100 million program to maintain relative equity among the various sized communities throughout the state. That leads back into another problem, which I'm sure you would appreciate, that you're going to have your entire capital budget tied up in this program, and I'm not sure there's anybody around this table sees this as anything but a, complement to our normal budgeting process. Once you start getting the big dollars here, it's not just so-called district priorities that may get squished. It's statewide capital too, including Village Safe Water, Priority One schools, and a host of other things. So, the larger project argument at some point has to get back to our purposes section here, that this is not, in my mind, designed to be the cure-all for all projects that a village wants. And when you get into the bigger projects, probably the more realistic approach is, no, you're never going to save for the large project. That's where legislatively directed grants and statewide grants come into play, which, anything that we would do, I would hope that we would make it abundantly clear that this is not to address all the needs that occurred in areas regardless of size, particularly those small areas where, you know, you're absolutely right. I can't foresee you ever building a Village Safe Water project or something of that magnitude with $25,000 a year. On the accounting standpoint, you know, again, I think you're right. We need to look into that. On the other hand, extending the lapse portion does not help that situation. I think you do need a lapse for exactly the same reasons you outlined for accounting purposes. You can't have outstanding balances on the books for long periods of time in some holding pattern. I mean, that's not good from a financial standpoint. It's not good from an accounting standpoint. Senator Ewing.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You had mentioned that it was a compliment to the capital budget of what we're doing. I guess my only concern is that when we do have a revenue shortage and the revenue is down in one particular year, and let, you know, I assume we could still pick and choose if we wanted to fund it. We wouldn't have to, but I would hate to see you know, $100 million capital budget is all you've got. It's all going to go to this grant program. I think my concern about it is that if it's in this grant program, there's all this money that's out there, but it's just being allocated on a per capita basis. I'm just taking, this takes the power away from the legislature for making decisions on that part.
No doubt about it. Yeah. Further questions? Mr. Chesney, did you have any comments on, we're just in the middle of discussing Senate Bill 141. Did you have any further comments from the administration?
No, as long as we can talk before you pass it out.
We're not going to pass it out now. We are going to continue discussions and also to give the administration and the committee a chance to look at some of the scratchings on the finance CS and also look at the impacts of different levels of appropriation. If there's no further discussion, we'll temporarily lay this bill aside, and let's get back to SPS HB 221 and the accompanying appropriation bill HB 51.
What are the two numbers again, Mr. Chairman?
HB 51 is the appropriation bill for the investment loss fund, and House Bill 51 and House Bill 221 for the creation of the investment loss trust fund.
Have we got a motion on the table?
We don't have a motion on the table. Maybe take up the authorizing piece of legislation creating the loss fund. It's now a finance CS for the House Bill CS, and as you may recall from yesterday, the only thing we did was on page 3, line 14, we added Legislative Budget Audit Committee to the notification list for the for the reporting by the Department of Revenue. Was there any further discussion or further suggestions on 221?
HB 1?
HB 221.
Yeah.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, just so we can get something on the table here, we have not adopted this proposed CS, right?
We did adopt the finance CS yesterday.
We did adopt the finance CS with that change.
Right.
Okay, then if that's done, I would move that we report out committee the Senate committee substitute for House Bill number 221.
Unanimous consent.
Discussion, objection. If not, 221 Finance CS moves from committee with individual recommendation. Then that would bring us to the more vexing problem here of House Bill 51. For members who were temporarily absent here, Mr. Keller, I hate to keep calling you back and forth, but there may be additional questions from some of our other members. We, for members who weren't present, we again have been trying to ascertain what Section 2 will mean to auditors, others looking at whether or not we have fully funded potential maximum liability of the fund, and whether or not there will or will not be $93 million and what that means in our budgeting process. We talked a little bit about the problems of a constitutional constitutional reserve appropriation, and frankly, it's kind of one of, we're down to just frankly a judgment call on whether or not this form of appropriation is going to be sufficient for avoiding writing down policies, writing down the SBS accounts come September, October. We had also pursued whether or not Section 2 is viewed as a one-year appropriation or whether that can be viewed as continuing in the future should there be additional monies carried forward for the statutory reserve fund, and that does not seem to be a clear question at all. It's just an open question at this point. Further discussion or questions of the commissioner? Senator Adams.
No, I believe once we get done with SBS, then the investment trust is terminated, and the balance of the trust funds on a prorated balance is brought back to wherever we got that funding source from. And I think that's the way this going on to 221 on to the appropriation bill, Mr. Chairman. And I think that Mr. Keller would verify that.
I guess he's nodding his head yes. Senator Duncan.
Sir, I just wanted to hear from the commissioner about Section 2 as a way that language reads. It says, the sum determined to be necessary to fulfill the purposes of the trust not to exceed $93,100,000. So we're authorizing an appropriation not to exceed that amount, not determined whether that full amount would be needed. Is that correct?
The language is this way because the in the event that there are any recoveries that take place between now and the time that the audit takes place, that amount might be less. We don't expect that there are going to be any recoveries between now and then. But that's why the language is written that way.
But it ensures that this type of appropriation ensures that the accounts are held harmless.
Right.
It also assures that those folks who are receiving annuity payments will continue to receive full annuity payments.
Mr. Chairman, the total amount comes up to the $138.1 million, which is the amount necessary to replace the value of the executive life assets and guarantee the 30% that is currently been restricted by California on the 300 annuity payments that go out that come in to people in Alaska annuity payments each month. Our plan is to fill that 30%. Loss immediately from this appropriation while we try to seek recovery of that 30% from the state insurance fund, either the Alaska fund or the California fund. But we don't know how long that will take to occur, but as we see that as another source of recovery that would come back to the investment loss fund.
Okay.
We can come back to Senator Ewing.
Mr. Chairman, who are the what makes up the 300 annuity recipients?
Mr. Chairman, those are people that during the years 1987, 1990, when the state was investing in executive life, terminated, and instead of taking a lump sum payment, rolled over their SBS balance into an executive life annuity. So there were 300 people that chose that as one of the options of termination after they had separated from the state. When you terminate, you have four alternatives. You can leave your money in SBS until you're 70 years old and you have to take it out.
Yes.
You can get a lump sum payment,
right,
or you can roll it over into an annuity. And 300 people chose to roll it over into an annuity.
So you still think there's some liability there from the state standpoint on those 300 recipients that decided to opt into taking a choice, or don't you think that was sort of their choice?
It was their choice, but the problem we ran into is that normally those losses are covered by a state insurance fund that covers any kind of a collapse of an insurance company. And we thought that's where the 30% would be covered, but since then we've looked at the form of the contract that the state used, and it's not a clear cut that the contracts were done in a correct manner that made sure that any loss would come from that fund. So to make sure that issue gets settled, we think we have to add that it adds about $3 million into this, into the total.
Plus, it's kind of an equity or moral here if you want to fill the rest of it.
Senator Duncan.
Yeah, but I think that's been clarified. I think I'm comfortable with that question. But I want to go back, looking at the House Bill 51, and I want to be sure I understand the effective date section. There's three of them. And they seem to be a little bit repetitive. There must be some reason why we did, why this was done in the House. Section 2, which is the appropriation of the $93,100,000, takes effect only when we pass House Bill 221, which creates the investment loss fund. That, I understand that. And then Section 8 says Sections 2 and 7 of this Act take effect on the later July 1st, 1991, or the effective date of an act enacted by the first session that creates investment loss trust fund. So you've got two effective dates for Section 2. One says it takes effect when we pass the bill. The second one says it takes effect either July 1st, 1991, or the effective date of the... I'm not quite sure why we need those two effective... We've got an immediate effective date on 221. Why do we need Section 8 that says either July 1st, 1991, or the effective date of the bill? And then why do you need Section 9 that says, except as provided in Section 8 of this act takes effect on the effective date of an act of the investment loss fund? Why don't we just make the whole thing effective when we pass 221? On the effective date of 221.
Is Mr. Baldwin, can he help on this at all? Or
sounds like something that the attorney thought
who,
was...
We don't have our bill drafted. It was a House bill,
yeah,
unfortunately.
The House drafted this. I think, as I recall, there was a question on whether the statutory budget reserve, on when the statutory budget reserve fund was going to be effective, that there is a legislation from last year that is going to affect the statutory budget reserve fund on June 30th of this year. And I think the question here was to allow the appropriation to either come out of the statutory budget reserve fund this year, or as of July 1st, it will have a different number in it. So,
well, but Section 8 says it takes effect on the later of July 1st, 1991, or the effective date of the act. Why don't we just say then that this whole act takes effect? I mean, if that's a concern, let's make it clear. It should either take effect July 1st, 1991, or it should take effect on the effective date of the investment loss trust. The whole act should. It seems to me we've got circular effective dates, which I'm not even sure I understand what it means, when it takes effect. So I'm trying to, in your opinion, when should it take effect? Immediately or July 1st?
Mr. Chairman, we need the thing to be effective when the audit takes place. The audit will be sometime between July and September. So from our standpoint, the auditors, we need to be able to point the auditors at something and say that's where the funds are. So
when do you need the money to replenish the accounts and to be sure that the annuitants receive 100% instead of 70%? Are you going to wait and pay them a difference July 1st, or are you going to start replenishing that money immediately? The way this effective date reads, I don't think the money is available for July 1st. I think, but I'm not sure because I don't understand the effect.
We've asked for our bill drafter to come over here and maybe explain that. We might as well get an understanding of what that's supposed to mean.
Yeah, and I understand you didn't draft this, but I wanted to understand, do you need the money immediately or do you need it July 1st?
July 1st is okay because there isn't a cash flow problem if that was the case. I think if we knew that it was going to be effective in the future, on the books, then there's sufficient cash flow in the system to pay the 30%. I mean, so that if we know it's going to be there, we won't need the legislation for a cash flow consideration.
So you
I think
could,
that's how we would proceed.
You could pay the 300 people who are receiving reduced annuities, you could pay them the full annuity off of cash flow up until July 1st, knowing that the money was going to be there?
Yes.
Well, I think we should, maybe you want to think about that for a minute, too. I mean, I want to be sure. I'm not questioning your statement, but I want to be sure, and I maybe you got someone to visit you there on your right shoulder.
Mr. Bader, do you want to identify yourself for the record?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Gary Bader. I'm Director of Retirement Benefits. In response to that question, making the annuity holders a whole during this interim, I think it would be a very unwise practice to try and pay them out of SBS funds, out of the participants in the fund now. So I think that we would need the funds immediately in order to take care of those annuity holders that are getting 70%.
And maybe maybe that's what these effective dates do. Maybe maybe Section 9 provides the $15 million or the $45 million would be what you'd be paying the annuitants out of.
Mm-hmm. We could pay them out of any money in the trust.
Okay.
Yeah.
But we seems like we should have. Or maybe that's what this does.
We clearly need a better understanding of that. I wonder, we're having Ms. Bannister come over from our legal
maybe that's what this does.
Over here, but I wonder if I could call on Mr. Barker from Legislative Budget and Audit. Ms. Barker, do you have an understanding of this? Did you participate in this at all?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I inquired after the fact about the reason for the language, and my understanding is that the peculiar effective date for Section 2 you see there is because that section would take effect the later of July 1 or the effective date of House Bill 221. And in the event House Bill 221 did not pass, the appropriation of Section 2 would still take effect on July 1 were it not for that other section there that provides it takes effect only if the bill does pass.
So why don't we just say the intent is that Section 2 would take place only if 221 passed. Is that the intent? And Section 1 would take effect immediately to hold the annuitants harmless.
Well, the entire bill would take effect immediately and only if 221 passed.
Why would he do that?
None of the appropriation would take effect, none of that bill would take effect.
How hard will it be?
No, I think. Oh, maybe you're right.
Yeah. In other words, if 221 didn't pass, then there would be no appropriation for something that didn't exist. Logical,
well, then it seems what we should be saying is that this takes effect only on passage of Senate Bill 221.
Right.
Period.
That'd be simple.
By the effective date of 221.
Information left. Are we ever contingent in appropriation on effective date? I guess we have.
Why don't, you know, before pending Ms. Bannister coming here, what are the elements that, can you clearly state the elements that you would require on certain dates? I mean, what is it that is necessary for the program to work in
Mr. Chairman,
terms?
I think the elements that are necessary is, one, in terms of holding the SBS accounts whole, that it is necessary to have a bill passed by the legislature in knowledge that the governor has to sign it, and that would allow us to distribute the funds at 100% of their value. We would also require, in order to set up some sort of program immediately to hold these people that are getting 70% of their annuities from Executive Life, in order to establish a program for them and have authority to expend, we would need those funds immediately.
Okay. So you need some funds immediately.
Yes.
You need the bill to pass immediately.
That's correct.
Well, then the answer is quick.
Right.
By my head, I think the answer, if we can do this, the answer would be clear to make 221 effective immediately.
Yes,
sir. And to make this act, all this act, effective on the effective date of 221.
Yes.
Instead of just circulating.
Unless there is some problem with funds that I don't understand in terms of what the division needs to proceed, we need to.
Well, it could be that there is this element of the statutory budget reserve fund and whether and when that takes place, because my guess is, from rough memory, There is no money in the statutory budget reserve now, immediately, or prior to July 1. But that money only becomes available sometime when the accounts are balanced after July 1. So, but I guess the question is, what does that matter? I mean, you know, if something here accesses that at some point in time, then that money goes into the loss, but the fund, but the $45 million is in there immediately. Of course, the other element is just from our own accounting is whether or not you want a $45 million appropriation out of FY91 or FY92. That, you know, has some budgetary concerns, and I guess my reading of this is that I don't know. It looks like the $45 million might be in FY91. Is that your reading of that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, yes, that was, I think when we talked about this with the House, that was part of the scheme, is that the general fund appropriation would be FY91,
and then the other would, budget would reserve fund would be by FY92. Definition, by their effective date, would necessarily be after in FY92. But it has to be in 92 anyway. The money won't be available until 92. Well, again, I apologize. If we could just hold on this bill to... We could skip to the funding. Let's hold in advance the question of that, and maybe Ms. Bannister can help us somewhat. Why don't we go to the funding source question? And Senator Adams, yesterday when we left off, there was a proposal in a form of amendment by Senator Adams that we did incorporate in a, and again, this was just for the benefit of discussion, a proposed finance CS that merely switched in Section 2 the statutory, or switched for the statutory budget reserve fund source, the constitutional fund source, that is incorporated in this draft finance CS. The House bill before us obviously just has the statutory budget reserve. There are clearly lots of problems with the three-quarter vote on the constitutional reserve, Senator Adams.
Mr. Chairman, if there is no three-quarter vote on the particular language that is stated on page 1728, then I believe that the amendment can be brought forward to do the statutory budget reserve fund at that particular time if the CS fails in the first vote.
Senator Petula.
Of course, if you have the amendments and you want this bill to move along, it must. If you have the amendments prepared and ready to the floor, if it fails, then the Muckluck Telegraph is out there anyway, and it will fail. You know, if there's any alternatives that are obviously quite available, the Constitutional Budget Reserve as an area of funding would just not probably be adopted. They'd recognize the alternatives.
Well, I would think that the reverse would be the more prudent course. I mean, yeah. You would, see if you get on the, if you people want to do a constitutional amendment, I mean, a constitutional reserve on the floor, you see if you get the three-quarter. If you don't get the three-quarter, you have the statutory reserve. Rather than the reverse.
You could do it two ways. One, you could have an amendment to the bill that gave you the constitutional method of funding.
Right.
Went down.
Right.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Duncan and Senator Lynn.
I'd be more comfortable sending the bill out with the statutory budget reserve.
Sure, I would.
And then, because I think we need to keep this on track and making a change here on the funding sources, I think
we had a month.
Good cause to delay. And if there's someone who wants to offer an amendment on the floor to move to constitutional budget reserve, although it's not clear to me what that really means, because we'd have to have an opinion. An amendment on the floor to change statutory to constitutional budget reserve only takes 11 votes. But then to get final passage on the bill, does it take 3/4, right? It becomes a little bit more complicated than just say you got to have 3/4 to adopt the amendment, because I don't think you do.
No.
The amendment could be adopted.
It'd be a vote like an effective date or like a court rule on the final passage.
I would recommend the Finance Committee stay on track here with the statutory budget reserve. Other other attempts at funding sources might cause serious problems to legislation either on our side or on the House side.
No, it's the late date is the problem. I'm sympathetic only to Senator's position because of the late date.
Yeah, well, I agree with that. I think we could go ahead and just do the statutory budget reserve. If, in fact, there was a situation where we could do constitutional amendment on the floor, that's another question.
Because I wouldn't commit if one was offered. I might support it. But I don't think it would pass with other alternatives being available. It's going to be the closest thing. This one that we're off. If there are no funds at all, Mr. Chairman, available, constitutional budget reserve would kick in and it would be voted for.
Concurrence on the motion on the House side, Mr. Chairman, would require a 3/4 vote under a constitutional amendment.
Sure.
On, added on the bill, otherwise it's just
both bodies.
Both bodies. Kind of stalling for time here. Maybe looking for Ms. Bannister here. Senator Hoffman.
I think that we should be looking at what the fund is best to address this issue, and not whether or not we're going to get the necessary votes. We are the Finance Committee, and we should make that pitch to the rest of our colleagues. You know, if we feel that the statutory budget reserve won't have enough money, then we should go forward and say that's our concern, and that is the reason why we are looking at funding the constitutional budget reserve and go with that avenue. We shouldn't be saying, well, we don't have enough money. I mean, we don't have the necessary votes, therefore we're going to go with the one that would get the less votes. We should be looking at where the money is and go that direction. If it makes sense to us.
This doesn't make sense.
Senator Catula.
Well, I haven't been very sympathetic to the position proposed by Senator Adams. I think we both were discovering fire there. The point, though, is it's the time available. You never change your mind except for reason and good sense. And the bill's delay may give us problems just because of that constitutional budget reserve battle, and then subsequent, I predict, loss. I don't think we're down so close in the budget GF that they won't choose that alternative. I'm just guessing now. If the amendment was offered on the floor, I'm not sure how I'd go on it, even so, but I think it's the time that the chairman's got to get this bill through that covers the SBS problem. Other than that, I favor that particular area of funding.
Well, on the floor, Mr. Chairman, if I may proceed, we have reconsideration votes, and I think if we're concerned about the time, I think there's the procedural mechanisms available before us to go through what Senator Adams is proposing on the floor and still do it procedurally in the same day.
Ms. Bannister, can you help us on another problem, perhaps? We appreciate you coming over here so fast. We're trying to make sense out of the effective dates on page 2 of the House passed bill, how they're interlocked and what they mean, what was trying to be achieved there. If you could state your name for the record.
I'm Terry Bannister. First of all, the goal of the section 7 and 8,
Senator Duncan.
The goal of basically section 7, 8, 9 are to tie this appropriation into House Bill 221. That's where you see language in. But we had to have the three sections because there was a request for an effective date of at least July 1st, 1991 for section 2.
What do you mean at least? You mean not?
Well, they said they wanted it to go into effect on section 2 regarding the budget reserve fund. They wanted that to go into effect this is my understanding, on July 1st, 1991.
Not sooner than July. They didn't want it to take effect sooner than July 1.
Yeah, right.
Excuse me. I'm sorry.
So there's a possibility that the House Bill 221 would go into effect before July 1st, 1991. So we put it at the later of those 2 days to make sure at least hit July 1st, 1991.
So the first appropriation of $45 million would go into effect immediately or when the loss fund...
It takes effect on... it's covered in Section 9. It takes effect on the effective date of House Bill 221.
Which probably or most likely would be before July 1.
Most likely, yes.
Most likely. And then Section 2 would take place after July 1, but also with creation of the lost fund legislation.
Yes, right.
So that it's a separate accounting for those two particular appropriations.
Yes.
The throwaway question is there any simpler way to do that, or is this the way that...
No.
Okay.
Unfortunately.
Senator Duncan.
Mr. Chairman, I understand that, what that does, but I guess I don't understand why we do that. I mean, I don't know if there's a real justifiable reason. I guess we need to ask somebody from the House why sections 2 through 7 shouldn't take effect earlier than July 1st.
I can't
answer that. I understand that. So I guess we need to go back to that. That's still my question. Does that cause a problem, Commissioner, or Gary, or whoever wants to answer, if sections 2 through 7 don't take place until July 1st?
Mr. Chairman, I don't believe it's a problem. The Section 1 will put money into the investment loss trust fund so that we can continue the any kind of recovery on either the 30% on the annuitants or any lump sum payments, my understanding. And then the balance of it will be for the benefit of the auditors to make sure we don't have to do anything to all the other 22,000 active accounts.
Further questions?
One other question, just because I want to be sure that that doesn't cause a problem. So, if we have the decision of the PRS board at their last meeting was anybody who had applied by May 3rd, had quit state, terminated, applied by May 3rd for a lump sum payout, anyone who applied by that date was going to get 100%. Anybody after that date was going to get 70% or 80%. I forget what.
Yeah, it'd be approximately 80% until something happens like this legislation.
But if we pass this with an effective date for the $93 million of July 1st, if someone applied on May 4th, will they get 100% prior to July 1st, or will they have to wait until July 1st to get 100%?
If this passes, then we'll continue the 100%. There would be no... This would, in effect, give us the authority to not freeze any portion of it.
Even though the 93 is not available until July 1st.
Right. That one would be more of a cash flow consideration because the lump sum distributions come out of SBS funds. And so that one, we don't need this for a cash flow reason.
So structured this way, everybody gets 100%.
That's right.
Commissioner, while I have you here, one more time, can you quickly address what we're doing to head off potential liabilities to on SBS? For example, new employees coming in, what information are they now getting? Are they still getting some of this information that says guaranteed interest or guaranteed investment? Are you changing the literature, the materials that new entrants into the SBS program are getting?
We haven't made any of those changes yet. Gary may be able to answer that a little more fully.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I think that we have every intention of sending a letter to all SBS participants advising them of the status of their accounts. We're anticipating that there will be some action by the legislature very soon, so we're holding off the letter until we know exactly what the situation will be. The SBS booklets with reference to guarantee were distributed a while back. I think that, and they still have that.
What are you giving new people, new hires?
They're probably getting the same thing. we can get a letter to personnel officers today.
You might even consider a letter inside the book you're giving them.
Yes.
I just think it's only prudent we not build more expectations that may or may not be there. Further discussion? Why don't we then get back to the... before us is the CS for House Bill 51. Senator Kutula, is he... Why don't we just hold a minute and see if Senator Kutula is...
Why is the vote street free?
We're not taking any chances here.
Schultz, you know something? Is the vote street free?
Okay, before us then is the House Bill for 51 finance. What is the desire of the
precisely?
It's exactly...
It would be exactly the form that...
you now understand the effective dates, everybody does?
I believe so.
Everybody but one member.
Right. Trust us.
At least one.
Just requires a concurrence motion on the other side.
No.
It's all done. It's all passed. It's done. Oh, okay, that's right. If you pass it this way, it's done.
Now, we did make... keep in mind, not exactly. We did. We made a change in 221. This bill is wrapped into passage of 221. The House would have to concur in our change to 221.
I think they would, because they're the ones that amended the reports from the Exxon Valdez and so on in that should all go to budget. And I think it's consistent with the President's philosophy now.
Action on the bill. Senator Euling.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move out Senate. I would move out House Bill 51 Finance.
Discussion on the motion. Objection to the motion.
Which one are we moving out to?
This is the House passed version.
Well, the question I guess that I have is the question that we discussed yesterday. Is there going to be sufficient funds in the statutory budget reserve? And are we setting up passing legislation that does not have the necessary funds, and we're just playing with smoke and mirrors? And I wonder if there's anyone that can give us an idea of how much their best guess will be in the budget reserve.
Well, I can tell you a scenario.
Senator Kutula.
With a flurry of production over at the media center, attested to by two or three members of the administration, the governor will state very strongly, with great flourish, the wastrels of the legislature have met, spent the whole state budget, and hence I have to cut. And there will be sufficient funding, believe me.
So we're setting ourselves up?
We will also have a blast of, and we'll probably have some drum and fife and bugles besides.
So what we're doing here is setting ourselves up so that the governor has to cut the budget in order to fund this.
They're delighted to have yet a further excuse beyond just the necessary reductions, but then really to have an excuse for reductions, say, in educational components and so on. This is great policy. Right?
It is possible under our budget scenario, with except for the uncertainties of the capital budget now, with the kind of Senate budget numbers, there would be this amount in the budget, in the statutory budget reserve.
But with our plan, if we wanted to spend what we wanted to on capital, on operating, would there be enough in the budgetary reserve, statutory budget reserve, to fund this particular appropriation?
Senator Kutula can answer this also, but under our plan, yes, there would be, and perhaps this is not necessarily a burden on the Senate. Perhaps this is a signal to the House that they may want to try to also help meet those budget objectives. Senator Duncan.
Mr. Chair, I think there'll be sufficient money. I think probably no matter what we do on the operating budget, the governor's going to veto back. But I hope he takes into consideration that a lot of the increases in the operating budget are coming because I've received a couple memos from commissioners asking for higher numbers. I see the Commissioner of Public Safety walking through the room here just a few moments ago asking for probably an extra $1 million in his budget. So the administration on one hand is saying cut the budget, the governor is, but the commissioners keep asking for more. So it's a tough balancing act for us to do what the governor wants and respond to the commissioner's concerns about programs. And when the Commissioner of Public Safety was just here, I'm sure he wasn't here to pay a social call.
Millett wrote his name down.
Yeah.
Fortunately, it's the administration, everything can be behind closed doors. The press never seems to be all that concerned. So, but the hottest, and most entertaining program will be OMB, a couple others, and all the administration's commissioners as soon as we leave town. It's far more interesting than we've been up to for the last few weeks.
The bottom line is I think there's some money here. So.
I would stay here just to await that championship round. I think we could sell TV on the front. It could help balance your budget.
I apologize to the members. I've lost track.
There is a motion on 51, and I don't think there was an objection.
Okay. Is there objection to... Oh, I know. Senator Hoffman, you had got your question statement. Is there an objection to the passage of 51, the House 51 from Finance with individual recommendations?
Okay.
If not, that bill also passes from committee with individual recommendations. The next bill before us then, again, we're reviewing SB 141, a capital project matching grant. Next bill, Senate Bill 235, Alaska Debt Retirement. Let me just say there's people I know waiting for a number of bills. We're going to go into session at 10. We will try to get through the debt retirement bill. We will definitely get to the Alaska Aerospace Development Corporation. I would like to get to Senator Ewing's bill on Peer Review Committee on the Board of Chiropractic Examiners 273. Beyond that, I think that we're going to have to... We don't have to get to it?
Yes, we do.
Oh, okay. Beyond that, I think it's... we probably will not get further in this morning session. Depending on the conference committee schedule, we will again try to have an afternoon session. We'll try to make that announcement at least during the floor session today. So that brings us to 235 Debt Retirement Fund. We've had the bill up before.
Chairman, the Conferees will be trying to meet during session, so if you make our appropriate excuses.
Okay. Depending on your progress, might there be an opportunity to try to reconvene here at 4? Is that a realistic?
4 or at the call of the chair, which might be earlier.
Okay. Why don't we tentatively say...
No, by noon.
Yeah, 4 o'clock, and then by the time we get off the floor, we will try to confirm 4 o'clock. Or sooner, perhaps. We've, based on our conversations previously, there is, a finance CS proposed for the consideration of the committee. It would not be my intention to move on this bill pending further review by the committee and also talks with the governor's office. This, again, is a governor's of the governor's highest priority. The finance CS before you deletes the references to the constitutional fund. The authorizing language for a constitutional fund would most likely have to accompany a constitutional amendment. That bill is in Senate. It's not in before us in this committee. It's not apparently going to move this year, so there's no need for those references in this particular bill. The administration had put in lease purchase financing as debt in their discussion paper. There are not the necessary references in the bill. I have gone back and picked up those lease purchase references in the bill. That is approximately $11 million now for the Seward Prison and I think Palmer Courthouse, perhaps some others. There was some questions on legal opinion. I don't know, Senator Duncan, I think you were talking about the perhaps contradictions in the administrative position on these kinds of funds.
They convinced me they're not contradictory.
Okay, we do have some backup from Mr. Baldwin and also our own...
On that legal opinion, we'll get another one next time, since we are, right?
Okay. I don't foresee any... This would be set up much the way Rail Bell Energy Fund or other funds that would be subject to our appropriation. Mr. Stastny, or I don't...
Mr. Chairman, I'm Jack Kreiner from the Shelby's in a meeting with the governor asked us to just give him a call and then run down to
the... Okay, was the administration desirous of making any particular comments at this time?
No, I don't think so on the changes there. We did look at the lease purchase debt, and I don't think we want to change the bill to include that. We're satisfied with just covering the general obligation debt.
Who have you been talking to about that?
Pardon?
Who have you been talking to about that?
I've been talking to Shelby.
As of what time? I've talked to him at 7:30 last night, and he was most interested in including lease purchase, so I think, why not, yeah. Maybe I was overly convincing in my arguments, but I... We're not moving the bill now, so if we just get clarification on that point, that would be helpful. The second part of this is the question of the appropriation bill. Originally, there were two components to funding of the debt retirement. One would be the placing of the 91 windfalls in the budgetary reserve fund into the debt retirement fund. We already know there is virtually nothing left of that, and what little left is going into the SBS pursuant to our last action. So the other remaining source of fund was going to be a constitutionally dedicated stream of revenue from mineral leasing, from royalties and other oil and gas tax measures. That constitutional amendment is not forthcoming and is not available. In lieu thereof, there is interest on the part of the governor or the governor's office that, at least from kind of getting into the rhythm of how this might work, that this year's allocation for debt be put forward in some other appropriation vehicle for direct deposit into the fund. That money then over in FY92 would have to be paid out for school debt, for lease purchase, and for GO bond debt. Assuming we meet all of our obligations, that would leave us with a zero balance in next fiscal year. I don't know what is achieved by that, other than it would set the stage for how the system is to work. There is currently about $209 million or $208 million in the operating budget to pay to fully fund all our debt obligations. One proposal would be that we would move that money out of the operating budget, put it forward in another appropriation bill for deposit into the retirement fund established, and it of course would be linked to creation of the fund in much the same, hopefully more straightforward way than what we just saw in the SBS account, but subject to the approval of the fund. If it weren't approved in the fund, I would suggest that the appropriation would go directly to pay those obligations, so that the obligations are paid one way or another. But if the fund were established, the money would go into the fund would pay the obligations, and that would set the stage for how the situation would work. In the future, the goal or the desire of the administration would be that you maintain a constant level of funding. As debt payments go down, the surplus money would be used for capital projects. This 235 before us provides that unused monies could be used for capital projects subject to appropriation, which would be our normal way of handling fenced off funds within the general fund. I think, again, Senator Adams, if there are questions or discussion, now suggestion. We should look at it. And yeah. Senator Adams.
My suggestion is on page number 2, starting with lines number 1 through 9, we go through the Alaska Debt Retirement Fund and we say 1, 2, 3, we're going to take care of these things. Number 4, if there's an unobligated balance remaining to finance the design and construction of capital projects, then I would ask, Mr. Chairman, that you look at language that we have presently in a bill, Senate Bill 141, that the legislature recognize the continued need for wholly state-funded capital projects, included education projects, construction as under Alaska State Statute 1411, which happens to be schools and education, and village safe water projects, one of regional and statewide significance, 2, which meets basic needs, or 3, for which cost exceeds the amount available for municipal or community under the capital project matching grant funds, if that. So I'm just saying that the language you have over in Senate Bill 141, perhaps some of that language can be transposed to go along with number 4 there.
There would be no particular harm done in that. We would have to, I think whether or not we want to further define capital projects in this bill for some particular purpose or another, recognizing though that we are still, we the legislature, would still be making the appropriations. Any appropriation would supersede that type of legislative intent, so that you would set the stage for intent, but the legislature would still be determining which capital projects would be funded from unused monies in the fund. Senator Hoffman.
Well, I think, you know, that would satisfy a lot of people's concerns, because it seems to me that whenever you're talking about school debt priority one, schools come up, and if we're going to be talking about funding, then this would place both of them in the same place, and we could address them together, and I think that would alleviate a lot of the problems.
Yeah, again, I don't know what the full intent of the administration is for capital projects. I don't think they were thinking of anything in particular, but presumably statewide capital interests would be, I assume, high on their minds, and those certainly could include that kind of language, you know, including things like priority one schools, things like Billy Safe Water, things like you know, other statewide facilities. We can attempt some language there, but again, recognizing this isn't setting the parameters. This is 235 debt return. Further comments, suggestions, questions? If not, we'll continue then reviewing this with members of the Finance Committee and the administration. And if we can arrive at some consensus, we'll be bringing it back ASAP.
Good.
The next bill before us is, let's go to House Bill 46, an act creating Alaska Aerospace Development. Representative Moyer?
He's not in here yet.
Okay. While Mr. Moyer is coming, Mr. Foose, do you want to start off testifying on behalf of the Commerce Department, or bring whomever you like?
What number again, Senator?
Oh, I'm sorry, Commissioner Oles, HB 46, whoever would like to speak to the administration on this bill, you're welcome to the table. Okay, we'll beat these guys up first and then go to you. Maybe you could both state your names for the record.
Paul Foose, Director of Economic Development, Department of Commerce.
Bob Boomer, Chief of Operations, Office of the Governor. I'll start first here. The bill has gone through five standing committees, the House ITT, Labor and Commerce, Finance and Rules, and passed unanimously in the House. From that point, it went over to Senate Labor and Commerce, where it was went through a final refinement. And at this point, the administration concurs with the changes. Also, the private company Microsat, who will be the first to launch a rocket from Poker Flats, is in agreement with the bill. And there are several other companies that have shown interest and have called in regard to utilizing Poker Flats on a commercial basis, therefore making it economically self-sufficient. It's very pivotal, the bill itself, in developing commercial space launches from Alaska, and it has tremendous potential for economic development in our state. It's an enabling act to promote private sector development.
And I'd just like to add somewhat of a sense of urgency on this, just in the fact that we're not the only game in town. But we've got the lead on everybody else, because we do have Poker Flat as the only non-federal facility in the United States. These companies are willing to sign on with us now to be the first to get through the door, and we're fortunate in that regard. So I just want you to know one more thing, is that we're working with ADA on this, and that they've expended administrative funds, $100,000 for a feasibility study for any capital improvements. We would intend to finance those through ADA, paid by revenues from commercial launches, rather than come to the legislature for a capital appropriation.
Senator Cotula?
I do have a couple of questions. As meritorious as this may be, how do you envision that we can protect ourselves against one way and another, tax-supported funding to lobby us for ever more effort and ever more funding. I'm very tired of state corporations using state ownership funds to continue, like New York, New Jersey Port Authority, to just go in and pick up components of the administration and the legislature as their dying supporters. And I don't like to create these kind of programs for that reason. And I don't see anything in here that absolutely prohibits you from frankly lobbying. And it's time we stop this. It's not correct. And as a result of putting together these type programs, you finally get in a position where you get an inordinate amount of public funds, public debt, and so on created. And none of you want to think about this, but I am thinking about it, and I'm quite antagonized by that aspect. It has nothing to do with substance. I said I want to keep you out of the trough using public funds, yet to assist you in doing so. And it's time, this new administration, and it's time that some new brains be put to work on this issue, and here's the place. I'm very concerned about that. That's one. Two, and I don't know whether it's constitutional or not, whether it's been to court or whether it's been just Attorney General's ruling, we must find out, but we're yet creating another board that has eminently more, has much more responsibility than the Barber Board, which we confirmed, yet we can't confirm the appointments of these boards that would help protect us against the very same thing I'm discussing. We must have a constitutional amendment if that's required, in order that the legislature may confirm these major boards, permanent fund boards, billions. The railroad, which you subsequently, is a major instrument, again worth probably $1 billion. We cannot confirm the appointments, yet we confirm it to barber boards and boards and so on. This is absolutely ridiculous and unacceptable. I'm pretty much hostile about all this area, and you've opened up this Pandora's box one more time with this legislation. And I'd like to see the administration's proposals, including commissioners, on what I'm concerned about. Lobbying with public funds for ever greater percentage of the public funds available, and creating great public debt, and we can't confirm your boards, and we can't prevent you from doing all this. And